So it's 1948. And there's a hill known as Latrun. When you drive from Jerusalem, the Jerusalem Tel Aviv Highway, you come out Shar HaGai past the Bab El Wad, where the convoys used to struggle against the Arabs in 1948, and you come out to the open plains, the Shvela, and you see up on your left, there's a fortress up on the hill. Today it's known as Yad LaShirion. It is the one of the central sort of monuments, memorials, Armored Corps Museum. Most of the Armored Corps, the tanks, ceremonies occur at Latrun. There is a story to this place. And there was a principal that was born in a battle in 1948, and that was the Battle of Latrun. The Jordanians were sitting on top of the hill. And if you drive by there, when eventually you're driving on the road, you will get there this year, you see that this fortress, it's a British-made Taggart fortress. It completely controls the entire area. So the Israelis understood that they had to take this hill. Now, we were hopelessly outmanned. We were certainly outgunned. But they had to take that hill. They didn't have enough seasoned soldiers. And because the Jordanians, by the way, were the best fighting force in the Middle East. Absolutely. They are the only Arab fighting force. They were British trained. They were French armed. They were an excellent fighting force. They still are today, but then they were really the best fighting force. They are the only Arab fighting force we consistently lost to. We lost the old city to the Jordanians. We lost Hebron to the Jordanians. We lost Gush Etzion. The whole of Yehuda v'Shomron, basically, we lost to Jordan. Right? Abdullah Tell was the commander of the Jordanian Legion, and he was determined that no one should take this fortress. The Israelis didn't know what to do. They were running out of men. Every time they did a charge, they were cut down by the machine guns. So they brought in extra manpower. Now, who was the extra manpower? Okay? These were refugees that had come in off the boats. This is one of the tragic stories of... it's going to be firm here. Right? This is one of the tragic stories of 1948. You had Holocaust survivors who had lost everything. I mean, their parents, their family, they wallowed in the DP camps and the displaced person camps in Europe, which are basically the same refugee camps, but with British guards instead of, you know, Americans, instead of Nazis. And eventually they were able to get aboard an illegal immigrant ship running the British blockade. You're going to learn about this year if you don't know about it already. Oh, shkoyach. Okay, thank you. And they managed to get on a refugee boat, and maybe they managed to get ashore, and they evade the British patrols so that they don't get sent to Cyprus or Atlit. You'll visit there too this year. And they want to fight. So they gave them a gun, took them to a ravine, taught them how to shoot a few bullets, and off they went to war. Now, you have to understand, you're a commander in an army unit, and you're getting new men, new soldiers. They're not really properly trained. One of them speaks Hungarian, one of them speaks Polish, one of them speaks German, one of them is from Greece. They couldn't talk to each other. How do you form a unit? 7 times Israeli soldiers tried to take this hill. And the men didn't know what to do. Now, no one knows who started this, and no one knows how this happened. But an officer realized there was only one way to get this men to understand what it needed them to do. And that was, one word, acharai, to lead. So Israeli officers founded a tradition at Latrun. If you go to Bad Echad, which is the officer's base, that's where every Israeli army officer trains. I spent a few months of hell down there. There is an engraved in the wall, the word acharai, after me. That's the principle of the Israeli officer. Follow me. You don't lead men by what you say, you lead men by what you do. And this, by the way, is not limited to the army. It's true in life. Now, there's a problem with this. It's not such a simple equation, right? It's very different, for example, from the Arab doctrine and the Russian doctrine. But, right, the Russians, the commanders are behind. They send the troops up ahead, and they manage the battle, right? We have a word for them, which I won't repeat here in the base members. But it's a debatable topic. And I'll give you an example. I remember about maybe 2 months after I became an officer, we were up in Lebanon, And we had a difficult mission. We had to take a village that was up in the Shuf Mountains. They were causing a lot of trouble. And there was a battalion briefing. I'll spare you all the details of the story. That's for another time. And they divided us up into companies. And every company was going to do their bit. And the company commander looks at me. Now, I was all of 6-7 weeks an officer. I was as green as you can get. And he looks at me and says, Tov, Friedman, this shelcha. Like, this is yours. Right? Now, fighting in mountainous zones, what's called lechima b'shetach harari, is a very difficult type of warfare. And there are many things that are unique to mountainous warfare. One of them is, by definition, you're going on mountain roads, you can't spread out. Tanks have an enormous amount of firepower. Okay? 52 tons of armor, full of tank shells, 3 heavy machine guns, right? If you're an infantryman, and 52 tons of armor is pouring down the road at you at 30 miles an hour, that is a terrifying thing, right? And if you have 11 tanks, which is what a company is supposed to be, and they spread out, that's an enormous amount of firepower. But if you're in the mountains, and you're going up a mountain road, you can't spread out. Not only that, the only tank that can fire usually is the one in front, because the one behind them obviously can't fire because it can hit the tank in front of them. So this is very difficult. And the Russians had a fixed war doctrine. What they used to do, right, because the Syrians worked according, we were fighting Syrians, they worked according to the Russian combat doctrine. They would take the turret off a tank with the gun, and they would put it in a mountain road defending a position, and they would, you know, sort of fortify it, and the only thing sticking out was the gun, and you're a tank coming up, or, you know, sort of up the road, and you're coming around a bend in the road, and the tank gun, the Russian tank gun of, let's say, a T-62 tank, is already sighted on exactly the spot that your tank is going to show up. And the gunner is sitting there with a shell in the breech. All he has to do is fire when you're exposed. It's a terrifying experience. Whoever gets off the shot first wins. And that makes a lot of sense. And the commander doesn't have to be here. It's a tank crew. So I was given the honor of, thank you very much, of being in front of the column. Why? Because I was just a lieutenant. And they discovered, especially in the mountains, and a lot of warfare in Lebanon was in the mountains, that the guy in front is usually the guy who gets it. So we were losing, you know, the battalion commander would always go in front, the company commander. But we were losing all our battalion commanders and company commanders. So they passed a rule in the army, which was big, very controversial, right, that no one above the rank of lieutenant could lead a column. They wanted to save the company commanders. And that makes a lot of sense. Because he's got, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years in the army, you don't want to lose that experience. Sacrifice the platoon commander. Now, it's not exactly a pleasant experience to realize that you're a tank fodder, right? And for years afterwards, I had nightmares about going around curves in Syria. But it makes sense. Which of those philosophies is right? On the one hand, acharai. Good men lead, you know? There's a saying, I believe it came from the famous football coach, the Gipper. And his line was, right, that leaders always want the ball. They always want the ball. They never throw it away, right? Same thing in the army. On the other hand, sometimes you're not meant to lead. So how do you find a rapprochement between those two approaches? So there is a fascinating detail in this week's parsha. Okay, this is a double parsha, Nitzavim Vayelech. Okay, both are very short parshiot. They very often come together so that Hazinu can be read during Aseres Mitzvah, which is as we're going to do this year. And I'm going to share with you a thought from Parsha Vayelech because I'm going to get to be here for Shabbat and we'll talk about Nitzavim tomorrow. One of the more, I think, difficult, maybe even painful, sort of pieces of this week's parsha is that this is one of the parshiot where Moshe passes the baton, as it were, to Yoshua. Now I want you to think about this. Alright? Nechama Leibovich, who I am sure I will be able to talk to you about many times this year, she was a tremendous Torah scholar. I learned how to learn Tanakh literally from reading her books. And if anybody wants to know what that means, you can ask me later. It's a great way to learn Tanakh. She believed that one of the challenges in learning is to try to put yourselves in the shoes of the characters you're studying. Rav Nevenzel used to say this all the time. By the way, we should say Baruch Dynamis, Rav Nevenzel's son was Nifter. So Rav Nevenzel is a towering, tremendous Torah Chacham. He was the Rav of the old city, one of the Gedolei HaDor. His son, the Rav of the old city, now slated to sort of really inheriting his position. And I heard that he was nifter today, so it should be Li Nishmato. We lost a Gadol B'Torah today. But Rav Nevenzahl in his Sichot would often say that on the one hand, you know, who are we to judge these towering figures of Tanakh? You know, like you talk about how could the brothers do what they did, and they're jealous of Joseph, whatever, of Yosef. These are people who are the sons of Yaakov Avinu. They had Ruach HaKodesh. They talked to Kosh Baruch Hu. You know, their mother was Rachel or Leah. On the other hand, if you don't try to put yourself in their shoes, if you don't look at them as though they're like us, then you can't learn anything. You have to find that balance, right? So we're going to do the same thing here. Remember, we're talking about Moshe and Yeshua. Don't anybody assume that I think that we can talk about them this way. But that's how we have to learn Torah. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe Rabbeinu, you're not going in. You're not going in. Right? We read a few weeks ago, Parashat Vetanan. Moshe Rabbeinu begs Hashem. Right? Ebrana ve'eret aretz hatova hazot. I want to cross over and see the land. He so wants to get into the land. Does Hashem answer him? Hashem answers him, right? Remind me your name?
Mikey.
Okay, Mikey. Hashem says yes, Hashem says no. Moshe says, I want to get into the land of Israel. Hashem says yes, Hashem says no.
No.
Okay. Now I want you to know, Mikey, you're right. You're right. Now that I told you you're right, I'll tell you why you're wrong. Somebody want to tell me why he's wrong? Moshe says, Ebra na ve'ere, let me cross over and see the land. Hashem says, you can't cross over. He doesn't say you can't see it. You could make a case for saying that Moshe Rabbeinu is saying, I want to cross over to see it. Hashem says, you can see it. You just can't cross over and see it. In which case, he says, yes. Alei na rosh ha-pizga, usai necha olei. Go up on the mountain. Lift up your eyes. And see. Yama, tzafona, right? Look to the north, look to the south. Right? So he says, yes. Moshe longs to get into Eretz Israel. By the way, just as an aside, here's a question. A few years ago, on the Boston Rebbe, he came to a Raita and he did a tish. And he was sitting at the tish and he said, you know, a 10-year-old kid asked him a question, he doesn't know the answer. Forget about, by the way, what the question was with the answer, which I'll tell you in a second. It blew my mind that the Boston Rebbe says, 10-year-old kid asked me a question, I don't know the answer. I thought that was so healthy. No? I still haven't figured out a good answer to this question. I think I remembered it more because it was a 10-year-old kid that asked me a question. Right? Right, so what does the pasuk say? Sana yerecha einecha ore, yama ve. Yama is towards the sea, is west. Yama vakedma, which is east. Tsafona, which is north. Vanegba, it's south. Look to the east. Look to the west. Look to the north. Look to the south to see the land of Israel. What's the problem here? Moshe Rabbeinu is standing up on Arvot Moav. He's standing on the Jordanian mountains. Which way does he have to look to see Eretz Israel? He has to look west. Now, I could say north because, all right, northwest. And I could say south, southwest. But why would he look east? He's already in the east. Makes no sense. Now, I've heard lots of different answers because I've asked this question, because the Boston Rebbe asked this question, because a kid asked this question. I have yet to get a good answer. If you have a good answer for me, by the way, one of the things we're going to learn this year, you have to answer it right away. Sometimes you can sit with a good question for a while, so come down afterwards if you have a good answer. I'd be interested to hear it. Right? One student once said to me, well, you know, maybe this teaches you that, you know, Israel is in our minds. That's not pshat. Pshat is he's looking. I heard once from a guy who lives in Har Bracha, which is a settlement up on Shechem. It's very simple because Eretz Israel is much bigger. Eretz Israel should include all of Jordan. And therefore, he should look to the east because that's going to be Eretz Israel one day. That's not pshat either. I wish it was, but it's not pshat. Okay? We can get into discussion of that some other time. Rami Tal vehemently disagreed with that, but I'm not going to go there right now. Moshe longs to get into Eretz Yisrael. Now that I said that Mikey's wrong, because Hashem says yes, now let's agree with Mikey. Because you could also say that Moshe yearns to be in Israel to see Israel. Now, who would better get that than you? You've been here for 2 weeks, but you're seeing Israel through a computer screen. And now you're here. And now you see it and you feel it. And it's different. He yearns to get into Eretz Yisrael. He spent the better part of his life preparing the Jewish people to come in, and Hashem says, you can't go in. Not only that, Hashem says, I want you to appoint him your successor. You know what the most painful thing is? Who do you think Moshe would have liked to lead the Jewish people into Eretz Israel? Anybody want to take a guess? Gershom. He was a ger, he was a stranger in the land of Egypt, and he's going to bring them home. Gershom and Eliezer, nisht. They disappear. That's a story for another time, where we find them again, but they disappear. This must have been so painful for Moshe Rabbeinu. And so Hashem says to Moshe, right? You gotta strengthen him up, make sure that people know he's the leader, and there's a whole discussion in the beginning of Sefer Yoshua. So now we get to our pasuk. Vayikra Moshe li Yoshua. Vayom elav leinei kol Yisrael. This isn't just that he's talking to Yeshua. The Jewish people have to see that this transition is happening. And he says to him, Ki ata tavo et ha'am hazeh. El ha'aretz Hashem yishba Hashem lavotam latet lahem. You will bring the Jewish people into the land of Israel, right? This people. El ha'aretz Hashem yishba Hashem lavotam latet lahem. A land that Hashem swore to give them. Ve'ata tanchilenu otam. You will inherit it for them, with them, of them. Okay. Not clear exactly what this means. Anybody notice an interesting problem with this pasuk? Should I read it again? Those of you who know a little Hebrew. Ki ata tavo et ha'am hazeh el ha'aretz. Asher yishba Hashem lavota. Anybody know what the problem is here? Yeah?
It says ki ata tavo instead of...
What should it say?
Bring instead of,
which, how do you say you bring? Ki ata tavi. It should say ata tavi. Good, no, good. What does tavo mean? You will come. What does tavi mean? You will bring. What is Yeshua being told? You'll come to the land of Israel? Well, you'll bring them to the land of Israel. It seems that there's a linguistic mistake here. But it's worse. Because who made this mistake? Moshe Rabbeinu. You say, okay, look, this is the Torah. So, if Moshe says something in the Torah, that must be what Hashem told him to say. Right? At some point this year, Professor Rabbi Dr. Josh Berman from Bar Ilan University, who is a Meshlita, who is a master in explaining and exploring the issues of biblical archaeology and biblical criticism, will come to give you a serious discussion. As amazing as the lecture is, usually lasts about an hour and a quarter, the question and answer session afterwards is much better. He stays as long as you want. And sometimes guys sign up afterwards for a lecture series, and Rav Noam organizes that. But, V'atat tavo el ha'aretz, right? So it would seem that Yoshua is being told, you will come to the land. But then you look a few psukim later, that's in Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Zayin, okay, 31:7. Now you look a few psukim ahead, let me just find it here, Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Chav Gimel, okay? Vayichtov Moshe, this is verse 22-23. Vayichtov Moshe et hashira hazot b'yom hu v'ilmadad bnei Yisrael. Moshe writes down the song, which is what we're going to read next week, Azinu. Vayetzav et Yoshua binun v'yom chazak v'yematz. Ready? Ki ata tavi et bnei Yisrael ha'aretz shenishbati lahem. So the first time it says ki ata tavo, and the second time it says ki ata tavi. Now, that's a little strange. Who's talking the second time? This is amazing. So, Torah Tumima points out, based on Rashi, that there's an interesting discrepancy between these psukim. The second one, which says, Atatavi, you will bring, it says, that I swore to them that they will get this land. Asher nishbati, I swore. But if you look in the first pasuk, ki atatavo et ha'am hazeh, do we have Balkorah here? Is anybody reading Vayelech? Anybody know what I'm going to say now? No? Okay. Asher la'aretz asher nishba Hashem la'avotam latet lahem. The first time it says tavo to the land that God promised them. The second time it says you'll come to the land that I promised to give you. So who's talking the first time and who's talking the second time? What do you think? I say that again? What's your name?
David Bentor.
David Bentor, okay, yeah. So the first time Moshe is talking, second time Kosh Baruch is talking. Because when it says Hashem Nishbati, that I swore, that must be Hashem talking. So now this gets interesting. Moshe Rabbeinu says, Atatavi. Hashem says, Atatavo. What is the difference between Atatavi and Atatavo? So here we have the Gemara. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, right? First of all, by the way, who should come first? Moshe or God? I would think first it would say what God says, and then Moshe will repeat what God says. I'll give you an example. Okay, in Parashat Matot Masa at the end of Bamidbar, Hashem says, Nekom Nikmat Midian, Nekom Nikmat Hashem, right? Avenge the honor, Nekom Nikmat Bnei Israel, avenge the honor of the Jewish people. But when Moshe repeats the commandment to the Jewish people, he says, Nekom Nikmat Hashem, avenge the honor of Hashem. So forget about what the detailed story there is. The word changes, but that's because Moshe's talking. Moshe's repeating to the Jewish people what Hashem told him. That makes sense to me. Here Moshe says something, and then Hashem says it. Why would Hashem be repeating what Moshe said? That's backwards. You understand the question? It's especially backwards because Hashem changes what Moshe said. Now, I don't know about you. I'm sure there are Gedolei Torah here in the room. But let's say, for argument's sake, what's your name? Remind me?
Bailey.
Okay, Bailey Lehrman. All right. So Bailey gives a fart. He's got an idea, you know? He's got an idea, right? He says, Atata V, right? It reminds us of the V, of the bumblebee. It has to do with tuna fish. I don't know if it's fish. There's a blousey there. So a blouse stands up and he says, look, you know, no offense, Bailey, but I think that's not okay. Let me just change your nusach. So the only way to understand that Hashem says something, repeats what Moshe said and changes it, is that Moshe was wrong. Moshe was wrong. How could Moshe be wrong? Well, because Baruch could say Moshe was wrong. Ask me an obvious question. Come on, ask me now an obvious question. Moshe says something, Hashem changes the nusach, Moshe must be wrong. What is the obvious question? Anybody, let's see. Hang on, Fightman, right? David Fightman?
Yes.
Ah, I got a name right. Baruch Hashem. New? Pardon? Okay, that's an important question. Why the difference? But if Moshe was wrong, and Hashem says the second nusach because Moshe was wrong, what would you expect? Remind me your name?
Al.
Al? Okay, Diamond? Is it Diamond?
With a T, yeah.
With a T, okay.
The question could be, why does it matter if Moshe's wrong?
Why does it matter if Moshe's wrong?
Meaning, like, you can make a mistake.
Moshe says, you know, don't honor your parents. I would expect Hashem to say, we're going to change that because Moshe's wrong, because we got to get it right. What would surprise me, though, yeah? Remind me your name again.
Zach Fisher.
Zach Fisher, okay.
Jack.
So I'm telling you, it's going to take a while. I'm going to get
there. Isn't Moshe usually just relaying the message from Hashem to the people, so how can he get it wrong the first time?
Okay, that's one question. How could Moshe get it wrong? But if Moshe did get it wrong, yeah, remind me your name?
Zach
Klinger. Pardon?
Zach
Klinger. Klinger, okay.
Why did Moshe correct himself?
Why did Moshe correct? Well, we'll say God corrected him.
Yeah, why did he correct him by saying...
Moshe says something and it's wrong. Then Akash Baruch Hu comes and says something else, so we say Moshe's wrong. What would you then expect? Yeah, remind me your name?
Evan.
Evan? Well, Moshe's listed first because he got it wrong, so Hashem corrects him. But what's the problem with that? Yeah, Simcha?
The question is, why would God say something to Moshe?
God doesn't want to embarrass Moshe. No, it doesn't look good. He just says a new thing. Rav Blau stands up. He doesn't say, listen, Lehrman, you loser, you're wrong. He just says something else. Everybody figures it out. No, it's last chance, David Edwards. Why is Moshe in the Torah then? What is this line doing here? By the way, you know what happens when you finally get it right. Tell them what happens when you finally get it right. Shana Bet. Okay? So, why is this here if it's wrong? Why would something be included in the Torah to be wrong? You understand? It can't be wrong if it's in the Torah. That's my premise. I know there are archaeology professors who would disagree with me. I'm looking forward to having that discussion. Right? If it's in the Torah, it can't be wrong. You could debate whether the Torah is divine. You could imagine my opinion on the matter. If the Torah is divine, there's no room. You know, I remember when I was a kid, there was a show, Happy Days. Anybody here ever watch Happy Days? Stupid show, right? There's some kid, There was some guy, his name was Arthur Fonzarelli, they called him the Fonz. He was like the cool guy, the Vinnie Bar, you know, the delinquent. He walked around in a leather jacket and a white t-shirt, never went to school. And he had his office. Whenever we wanted to have a serious discussion, he said, come into my office, it was the men's room. Why people idolized the guy whose office was in the men's room, I'm not sure. But he was the Fonz, he could never be wrong. So there's one scene where the straight guy, Richie Cunningham, right, is having an argument, right? And Arthur Fonzarelli, the Fonz, right? He has to admit he was wrong. Okay, so he's in the bathroom, because that's his office. And we're watching this and idolizing it. There's something wrong with us, but okay, right? And the Fonz is trying to say he was wrong, but he can't say he was wrong, because he's the Fonz. So he says, I was, and he can't say it. He says, I was, and finally Richie says, you're wrong. He goes, yeah, that's it, right? HaKadosh Baruch Hu cannot be, there's no in the Torah. So, was tutzach? So listen to this Gemara. Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Chet. Okay? It's an awesome thing when you read a parsha and you notice a discrepancy, and then you find the Gemara. And you realize, right, that no less than Rav Yochanan, who was really the editor of the Yerushalmi, right, no slouch, has this question. And he says as follows. It's on Daf Chet. Efchet Amir Aleph. What is this? K'tiv ki ata tavo. It says ata tavo. Uch'tiv ki ata tavi. So is it that you will come or you will bring? Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Amar lo Moshe li Yoshua. Moshe says to Yoshua. Now Moshe says the first one. So he says ata tavo. You will come. He says to him, ata v'yaz kenim shebadori mahem. You will lead the Jewish people, but you will lead them with all the elders. You're not on your own. Right? Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to him, now that's an interesting question, he says this to Moshe or Yoshua, Tul makel v'hachal kot kodam. No. Now all this, we're all together, let's make a committee decision. No. Take a stick. Anybody gives you a problem, slam them on the skull. Dabar echad ledor, ve'en shnei dabarim ledor. There can be only one commander. There can be only one leader. You're the man. Rashi notes this discussion and says, ki ata tavo et ha'am, you will come either with the people or the people. Mashma gam ata ke'echad mehen. When you come, you're going to be one of the people. You'll come with them. You'll be one of the guys. You have to exercise your power over them. In other words, there are two different messages being given here. There is a message of leadership. Sometimes a leader has to rule with an iron fist. And sometimes a leader has to be part of the people. Right? So, let's understand this. And one last thought, in order to understand this, we'll take a look at the Torah Tzimut. And then we'll put it together in another 5 minutes. Torah Tzimut, by the way, is an amazing sefer. Among the many things we're going to do this year, I'm going to introduce you to different books that you may not be aware of. Torah Tzimut, Rav Baruch HaLevi Epstein, was the son of the Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan, Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein, was a towering scholar. He was one of the Gedolei Ador. He was the undisputed halachic leader of all of Lithuania, Lita. And he was the Posek Hador. In fact, before there was the Mishnah Brura, which you'll learn about this year, the Chafetz Chaim, you know, in our generation, if you're not sure what to do, you look up Mishnah Brura, it'll tell you what to do. Before there was a Mishnah Brura, there was an Aruch HaShulchan. Full disclosure, my wife is a great niece of the Torah Tmima. She comes from the Epstein Alevi family. So when we got married, in the Yichud room, there's a custom that, you know, the Yichud room is like sort of you're alone together right after you get married. It's a very beautiful idea. The first thing you do when you get married, before you get with all the guests and everybody, you have to be with each other. You have to learn that you've now started a relationship where this person is your priority. It's a beautiful idea. And if you've been fasting on the eve of your wedding, which is a beautiful custom, you also get to eat. But there's a custom to give each other gifts. I won this one, hands down. Because I got my wife pearl earrings. I don't even know if she knows where they are. She got me an Aruch HaShulchan. I definitely won, right? Now, if your wife gets you an Aruch HaShulchan, because it's her great-great-uncle, you got to learn the Aruch HaShulchan. That's 12 volumes. It's all a shas and poskim. But you can't not learn what your wife gives you in the wedding room. It's an unbelievable sefer. It is an incredible sefer because he takes every area of halacha. First of all, the beginning of the Or HaChaim, theologically amazing stuff. He takes every halacha and he writes in such a clear, lucid, easy to understand Hebrew. And he goes through the whole sugya. What the Mishnah says, what the Braitot say, what the different Mishnahim say, and then explains why he rules how he rules. And he's one of those poskim that if you don't know what to do, even if today we don't pass like the Aruch HaShulchan, if you pass like the Aruch HaShulchan, you are covered. You really are. He's an amazing Talmud Chacham. And his son, the Torah Tamimo, was actually a businessman. But he wanted to prove to his father that he could learn. He wasn't a Rav, he didn't sit in Chinuch. He is a role model for a person who goes out into the world, becomes a lawyer, a doctor. It doesn't mean you leave Torah behind, right? And he wrote the Torah Tamimah. Now, the Torah Tamimah is a sefer that's written on Parshiyot HaShavua. And basically what he does is, usually most volumes of it include Rashi, because he very often comments on Rashi. He brings down pretty much all of the Gemaras and Midrashim in Shas. Right? So, for example, if there's a Gemara that talks about this Pasuk, or a Medrash, he will very often bring it down. Okay? And then he has a commentary underneath on sort of what's really going on in this Gemara. So if you want a great Dvar Torah on the Parsha, right, you can look up the Torah Tamima, and you can see what the Gemara says. You can find Machlokas Rishonim, it's an unbelievable, it's a cheat sheet to find out, you know, where something is spoken about. So the Torah Tamima on this particular discussion, he quotes this Gemara, right, which full disclosure is how I found the Gemara, right? He quotes the Gemara, and he says as follows, HaLashon Tavo Et Ha'am, Mashma Ata Ve'am. When he says tavo, you will come, that means you and the people. Atake echad mehem, you as one of them. Masha'en ken alashon tavi, b'chiri. But the word tavi, that's a totally different word. Moresh atatiyah meviotam, you are the one who brings them. You don't come with them, you're bringing them. You're leading them. Tehainu shetiyelem roshu manhik, that you should be a leader for them. Right? Umivuar, and it's clear, I'm skipping a line, Sheshina Kadosh Baruch Hu min lashon Moshe. Hashem changed the language that Moshe used. Shera'a l'tov sheyeh manig echad l'dor. Vegam. So, this is not a machlokas here. This is not a debate. I think the question here is very simple. There are two different aspects to leadership. You know, one of the beautiful things about the Israeli army, once you've finished basic, like basic training, maybe 6 months, whatever it is, we don't call our commanders sir. If you go to the American Army, right, they call Sarge, Sir, the officer, you don't call your officer by his first name. You call him Sir, right? But in Israel, so as soon as you finish basic training, they call you by your name. Now, the challenge with this is, both for the soldier and the commander, because on the one hand, you get very close with your men. There's a very informal relationship between officers and men in the Israeli Army. On the other hand, you have to remember you're their commander. You're not their buddy. You have separate quarters, and you have to create a relationship where on the one hand, you're so close with them that you're like brothers, and on the other hand, when you give an order to them, they listen without hesitation. Now, we're not talking about like, you know, when Corey asks somebody to do Torah Nut. I mean, that's obviously, is Corey here? Oh, he's not here? Full disclosure, tonight is Corey's, today was Corey's birthday. So everybody has to say happy birthday to him later and give him a chapcha. If you're in his pod, you can give him a chapcha on the back. If not, you can just clap for him. But anyway, if Corey tells you to do something in the tournament, okay, so you should listen to him. We're talking about a person who will tell you, right, a commander in the army, to run up a hill under fire. That's psychotic. So if you're their buddy, that's very hard to do. On the other hand, if you're just the guy telling people to run into combat and they're not close with you, you lose something. Because sometimes men will fulfill the wish of their commander because they love him like a brother. You know, one of the most beautiful scenes in Israeli society occurs on a Sunday morning. Okay? Every Sunday morning all over this country, right? Soldiers who were off duty and were home for Shabbat, they pack up their gear, right? Their freshly done laundry, a couple of care packages from Ima, and they head out back to their bases. And they go to the bus stations, and they fill up the buses. And alongside the regular soldiers, you'll see older soldiers, and those are the reserve duty guys. Now, the reserve duty guys, they very often haven't seen each other for a year, right? And it's a very unique set of friends. You have these friends, you know, I mean, I had It's a longer story, but I had two different reserve duty units because I switched midstream because they needed me to do something as an officer. But you become very close with these guys. You fight with them. You're in dangerous situations. You look out for each other. These are guys, you know, you have a friend you say you would give up your life for him. But these are friends you actually do. And they know you do, so you become very close. And then you go off, you leave reserve duty, and you generally don't see them during the year. And then you come back, and you haven't seen them in 6 months, 8 months, 10 months. And it's like you rediscover your brother. So how do you know this is going on? Right? Because I would get back to Miluin, and what's the word that somebody would say to you? Achi, 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 mayarim, right? And there's this big hugathon going on in the bus station. And you're like brothers. And it doesn't matter if they're your men, or they're your sergeants, or they're your commanders. You know, you give a hug to your battalion commander, you give a hug to the driver. But on the other hand, you have to get to a space where you know that when you give them an order, they'll follow you. Now, why do you need both? Like, what's the difference? Why do I need Tavo? Tavo to me represents Moshe Rabbeinu saying, be careful. Be careful. Because you're going to lead the Jewish people. You're going to lead a very special nation with a very special mission. And what you will tell them, they will have to do. And they will follow you. Don't get too big for your britches. Don't forget that you're not the goal. You know, there's a beautiful halacha. Okay? When a king, for that matter, Kohen Gadol, Navi, begins his role when he's chosen, he is anointed. Does anybody know what it means to be anointed? What do they do? Anybody know? David HaMelech, they take a horn of oil, Keren Shemen, and they tip it at the top of the forehead. Okay? And a drop of oil runs down the forehead. Now, you know, the briskers, you know, Stark people, they get it. How big does the drop have to be? How long does the dripping have to be? Is it a tefach? Is this a tefach? Is it? They're actually discussing this a lot. The Hasidim say, okay, that's important. But why are we dripping oil on a guy's forehead? Well, what a weird custom. You know? I mean, imagine that. You know, you come to a writer, you haven't been in before. Oh, anos damonos sanctimos. I mean, this is weird. What does oil represent? Oil is the vehicle to bring light into the world, but it's not the light. So the king, when he's anointed, the Navi, when he's anointed, the Kohen Gadol, when he's anointed, is told, just remember, you're meant to be a vehicle to bring light. You're meant to serve the Jewish people. You're not the source of the light. That's atatavo. You be sure that the Jewish people are walking with you. Kadosh Baruch Hu comes along and says, yes, but you also have to know atatavi. Right? Atatavo means, let's talk about this. You know? Let's see what everybody thinks. There's a validity to everybody's perspective. There's a value to discussion. Committees can accomplish a lot. Kadosh Baruch Hu comes along and says, yes, that's true. But sometimes, you have to make a decision. You have to know when to cut to the chase. And that's atatavi. And to be honest, I think this is true in life. It's interesting that in the first one, atatavo, it says am. Look at the pasuk, right? The pasuk again, pasuk lamed aleph pasuk zayin, right? The pasuk says atatavo et ha'am. It's just a people. When it says atatavi, when Hashem is talking, it says bnei Yisrael, because you have to be above them. They're like children, right? That balance. That's a balance of life. Sometimes you want to know what everybody thinks. You want to get a consensus. You know, you can't disagree with someone until you first respect his opinion. You know? But once you've heard every opinion, and once you value everybody's opinion, somebody has to make a decision. You can't have two captains on a ship. Right? Parents. Parents won't always agree, but sometimes you have to make a decision. And that's the challenge of atatavo. And I would finish by saying that this is your challenge. You know? On the one end, Moshe tells Yoshua he has to fight Amalek. It's one of the most difficult battles in the Torah. Yoshua takes fighting men, and he doesn't ask Moshe's advice. He has to lead them in battle. And Moshe goes up and sits on the mountain. Yoshua has to run the show. But not long after that, Eldad and Medad, actually long after that, but whatever, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp, and there's something going wrong. And what does Yoshua say? Adoni Moshe. He calls Moshe Adoni. which is about as close to Adonai as you get. My master. Because in the leadership of the Jewish people, there has to be a master. Right? That's the challenge. You are, whether you know it or not, you are a very unique and a very infinitesimal piece of the Jewish puzzle. Alright? They estimate that there are almost 14 million Jews in the world. What percentage of those Jews have a deep relationship with Torah, with mitzvot? How many of those Jews grew up getting the Jewish education, which I grant you is varied amongst this group, grew up getting the Jewish education that you get? How many Jews in the world, as teenagers, will come to spend a year learning Torah, growing in Eretz Yisrael? What percentage of them will actually get to live and learn in the old city of Yerushalayim? I want you to know in Jewish history, you can count the number of Jews who got to do what we're doing. When you leave here, after a couple of years, when you leave here, you know, for those few of you who decide to go back to college, this is being taped, by the way, right? When you go back to university, so you're just going to think, okay, I spent a year studying, you know, it was interesting. And then people are going to start asking questions. You know, they're going to come over to you and they're going to say, like, I don't know, Micah, like, can you tell us what the Jewish law is? And you're going to look at them like, well, what do you want from me? Like, you know, I came from Detroit, like, I don't know, right? But you have to understand that to most Jews in the world, a guy who sits and learns Torah in the Old City of Yerushalayim for a year, he's like a rabbi. They're going to think you're the Gaon Rav Avadia. And they'll be right. Because you're going to discover, you've already been given in your lives, you're going to be given a gift. And what's so beautiful about this gift is it's not being given to you in a silver platter. You have to earn it. You're going to work for this gift. You're going to learn, you're going to grow, and you're going to become leaders. You're leaders already, you just may not know it. You will be leaders. Now, leading doesn't mean that you have to get smicha. It doesn't mean you become rabbis. It doesn't even mean you're going to go into Jewish education, but you will be Jewish educators. Now, whether you're Jewish educators in a law room or a boardroom or a business or as a plumber, that's a whole separate discussion. Remember, as you go out of here one day, that leadership involves both of these things. Atatavo, you're not better than anyone else just because you discovered something beautiful in yeshiva, or your keeper's a little bigger, your tzitzit's a little longer. But at the same time, know that you're a leader. You represent something, you know? And now you represent a particular yeshiva, you're entering the world of Torah, and to the degree that you take that seriously, you can make a difference in the world. So that's a little bit of food for thought.